You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com.
But he would look at us one by one. He looked in everybody's eyes. He looked up the guy's eyes, but it was like one, two, three, like good 4 or 5 seconds. Looked in the girl's eyes and looked into mine eyes as well.
This is Cold War Conversations. If you're new here, you've come to the right place to listen to first-hand Cold War history accounts. Do make sure you follow us in your podcast app so that you don't miss out on future episodes. Zsolt Akos Pál was 17 when he decided to flee Cold War Romania for a better life in the West. It's a heartwarming story of the generosity of strangers. Young Zsolt finds compassionate border guards, gets lost in Vienna, and has incredible luck wherever he turns as he negotiates the Iron Curtain, as well as many other international borders, to reach his brother in Sweden. However, his escape is bittersweet as we hear of his emotional farewell to his parents, not knowing if he's ever going to see them again. Now, Cold War history is disappearing. However, a simple monthly donation will help to keep this podcast on the air. You'll get the Sought After Cold War Conversations coaster as a thank you, and you'll bask in the warm glow of knowing that you are helping to preserve Cold War history.
Hi, I'm Andrew, and I'm very proud to support Cold War Conversations with a small donation each month because Ian's put together such a brilliant range of interviews. If you want high power, there's the son of Nikita Khrushchev, there are cross-border romances, old-fashioned spy stories, and the bizarre world of East European football. If you do support the podcast, your wallet will be a tiny bit lighter, but your brain will be very, very thankful.
Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate. If you're on Facebook, do join our Facebook discussion group where listeners just like you continue the Cold War conversation. Just search for Cold War Conversations on Facebook. I'm delighted to welcome Zsolt Akos Pál to our Cold War conversation.
And remember sitting on the Danube shore and talking lies. And then I started thinking about going abroad. And I flipped a coin. And I said, well, if it's this side, I'm going to go. If it's the other side, I'm going to stay. And it came out the side which said that I should go. So that's how my decision was made. Although I have to mention as well that I had some reasons. So my reasoning before doing this flip a coin, it was like this. I'm 17 years old. I still have 1 year of high school. If I go back to Romania, I still have 1 year of high school. I finished school. Then I'm going to try to enter actor school. I know that I was kind of good, but I know as well that I didn't have many chances, or because at those years, they were taking in one student from the whole country. One student. You know, and although I know I was okay, I know that I was not a genius. So it's probably not going to be me. Which meant that I have to now do 2 years military service. If you entered the university, then you had to do, I think, 9 months. If not, then 2 years. So that adds, now are we up to 3 years. 1 year high school, 2 years military service. After you're doing your military service, you're not allowed to travel abroad for another year. I don't know why, but that's just how it worked. So next time when I could come to Hungary, not further, because we were not thinking of further. We were not thinking that the regime would alter itself. So next time when I could come abroad was at least 4 years away. Now, if I would be leaving now for the West, in 4 years' time, I might be able to come back. Because in 4 or 5 years, you might gain a citizenship somewhere. And probably I wouldn't do 2 years military service, which is, at that time, I considered it was a total waste of time. Certainly in the Romanian army. So that was my reasoning behind this flipping the coin. And when I flipped the coin, then from that moment on, you know, that was my my program. That was my agenda. So I called my brother. I said, all right, I decided myself, I'm going to go. Tell me the way, or tell me what should I do. You know, and then he started to explain me what should I do and how this whole thing. Should I go on with this story?
Yeah, I want to know how you do it.
Okay. So what he basically told me is that he just met another guy out there in Jönköping in Sweden, who told him how he managed to get abroad. And it was the following, that he went to the border crossing of between Hungary and Austria. And he simply walked in to the border crossing and explained that he is a Hungarian from Transylvania and he wants to go to Austria because he has some relatives there and so on and so forth. And since at that time Hungary was so benevolent to the Hungarians living in Transylvania, and they know the hardship they had to endure under Ceausescu, that in silence, non-officially, they let people go over the border. And then when, if you can cross the border, he told me, then you should get to Kufstein. There's another Hungarian guy there. You should seek him up, and he will help you further. So that's how much I knew, basically, about crossing the border. I presented my plans to my parents, who were there with me in Budapest. It was very funny because my mother was supporting me from the very first moment, and my father was very skeptical to the whole project. Said, no, this can't be, this wouldn't be, I mean, this is unreal, it cannot be. And what if they arrest you, and what if they put you back to Romania? What normally would happen? And I said, well, I don't know. This is what my brother told me, that he met a guy who went out this way, and I think I want to try it. You know, I'm here, I can try it. If not now, then I'm just going to waste a couple of years. And, you know, just who knows when. If I succeed, I succeed. If I don't succeed, I will have to take the consequences of it. So basically, they agreed to take me to the Hungarian border, which at that time, from Budapest, it's not too far. It's like 150 kilometers or something, or 180 or something like that to the border. But it took us a half a day. It was old to pay two-lane roads. And it was in August. It was August 1986. And it was a gloomy, rainy day. And so we drove all the way down out to the border. Of course, at that time, it wasn't one border, as it is usual now, so to say, but it was two borders. There was a pre-border where a checking was set up with a barrier and so forth. So everybody was staying in the first barrier. And then from time to time, they would pass on 3-4 cars into the big border, the real, so to say. And it was a huge queue. It was like, I don't know, like 800 meters, a kilometers queue of cars on the border. I said to my father, well, we shouldn't stay in the queue because this will take, I don't know, half a day to stay here. Just drove all the way in the front. So we drove because it was no traffic coming towards us, basically, just from time to time, one or two cars. So we went out to the first place, stayed on the left of the road, and I went out of the car and went to this little border. And there was a soldier there, standing there, and said, oh, what do you do? Why did you came here with your car? I mean, let's go back and stay in line, and so on and so forth. And I said, well, good day to you, sir. My name is this and this. I'm coming from Transylvania. I have an uncle in Austria. I would like to go there. You know, my life in Transylvania is not a great deal to brag about it. And yeah, that's what I would like to do. And he was looking at me as like, but what did you say? I said, well, yes, I'm a Transylvanian, you know, Hungarian from Transylvania. I would like to cross to the West. Well, you can't cross to the West like that. Do you have a passport? Well, yes, of course I have a passport. And I handed him my passport, looked at it. Well, you have no Austrian visa, he said. No, I don't. But then how do you want to go? I said, just, you know, I just want to go. Well, I don't know what to say. It's not possible. Well, wouldn't you mind calling into the central and just ask someone? I said, well, you know, I could do that. And said, yeah, please do that. So he picked up the phone, and I heard that he was saying, comrade captain, I have a person here. He's a Hungarian Transylvanian youngster. He wants to go to the West, to Austria. What should I do? And the captain told him, send him in. So he put down the phone, looked at me, and he said, do you have any luggage? I have a backpack in the car. Well, get your backpack, your passport stays with me, and then come back here. So I went back to the car, which was like, you know, 30 meters from there, and then took out my backpack from the car. I said goodbye to my parents, and they were still not believing that I'm actually going. I said, well, you know what? Go back and wait here for 2-3 hours. If I won't be back by 3 hours, then go back to Budapest, because if I don't succeed of getting over myself to the border, then I will be back to Budapest somehow, and I'll let you know. And that was it. I said goodbye, I took my backpack, went back to this little border check.
Can I just ask you, was that tough saying goodbye at that moment?
Yes and no. It was tough in a way because, you know, I knew that if I'm going to be gone now and if I succeed, I might not see them again. Mm-hmm. You know, I just didn't know it. But everything happened so fast that it wasn't really time for getting, you know, emotionally involved very much. You know, this is it. I'm going. All right. Thank you. Take care of you. Don't have any remorses. Don't have any of that. You know, it's my decision.
And being the age you are, you're looking to the future.
Yes. Yes.
Opportunity.
Yes. And later on, when my parents came out to Sweden as well, we talked about it. And they said they had a different argument in the car back to Budapest because my father felt so guilty about letting me go. I mean, officially, I was still a minor, you know, and then he shouldn't let me go and but on the other hand, which I understood later on, is that when he was talking about his life as well, he said at one point that, I have one big remorse or one big
regret.
regret, that's the right word. I have one big regret, that I had to live my entire life in this horrible regime. So that was some, you know, in him. And I think that was one of the reasons he let me go. Not to have the same kind of life. I mean, we didn't have a bad life on family level and on city level, or, you know, with our everyday life. I mean, we didn't have a bad life. We had I would say we have a quality life. You know, we lived and loved each other. We had friends. We have, you know, we're all kinds of communities, and you know, we were both partying and going to theater and so on. So we have a vivid community life back there in that way. But still, you know, when something is wrong from the beginning, something is, you know, the basis for the whole life is it's a lie, basically. And you have to live with that every day. So anyhow, later on when I was putting and I was rethinking what have happened, I think this was his reason why basically he let me go at that time. And then I went into the border station. I mean, I had to, I think it was like at least a kilometer or 2 or 3 kilometers. I can't really remember how long it was. To go into this big border, so to say, crossing this no man's land. one of the reasons why they had this double border system is that when people were defecting, you know, and they left the first border and they thought they are already in Austria. And then the Hungarian police could come and collect them, basically, because they were still in Hungary. Mm. It was a double system.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Clever.
Yeah, clever. Yeah, they were very clever in this way. So, I went into this big border station, and, you know, it was a vivid border station. People standing, cars, you know, in several lanes. And so on, and nobody paid attention to me. Basically, it was kind of funny. It's like, until now everything was under control, and, you know, blah blah blah. And now you come to the border, and nobody cares about you. So since I know that this guy on the border, the soldier was talking to a captain. So I saw a guy with 4 stars. On his shoulder, and that's a captain. So I approached this captain and I said, "Hello, sir, this is who I am. This is what I would like to do." And he says, "So what did you say?" I said, "This is my name. I'm coming from Romania, Transylvania. I'm a Hungarian. I would like to go over to Austria. I have an uncle there who's waiting." Okay, do you have a passport? Well, yes, of course, I have a passport. Okay, and you want to go over to Austria, you have an uncle there who's going to take care of you and so on. I said, yes. Okay, so look, there's a cafe over there. Go in, have a coffee. I'm going to go and check up your passport. And he left, and I went into the cafe bar and had a coffee. And he came back after like 20 minutes. And he asked me again, "So where you want to go? Where are you from?" I said, "Well, this is my name. I'm Transylvania. It says into my passport, I would like to go to Austria." "All right. Let's see. Well, your passport is okay. It's valid and wrong with it. Okay. And how would you like to cross the border? You know, if we're letting you go, what will you do?" I said, "I think I would hitchhike." "Ah, that's not going to work. It's not working right. All right, come with me." So we went up to the cars, which were staying in the line, and he was looking at the cars, and then it was a Zastava there, with a Yugoslavian license plate. It was 2 guys, a guy and a girl in it, and it was a minivan. And he asked them, "Where are you going?" They said, we are going to Vienna.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Now, if you take this young man along with you, we won't make any custom examination on you. Is it okay for you? I said, yeah, sure. And then he said, well, okay, this is it. And I believe that the Yugoslavian passport is, that the covers of the passport was red. My Romanian passport has a green cover. So he took out one of the guy's Yugoslavian passport from it. It had a plus cover as well with the state crest on it and so on, and put my green passport into a red cover as well. So it looked like three Yugoslavian passes, basically. Okay, he said, well, you see, these nice people will take you all the way to Vienna. I wish you well. I hope that when you will be coming back, then you will be coming back with that other's passport. Have a good life. And he walked away.
That is fantastic.
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't believe it, basically. You know, you were there, you were in the situation, but I have never, ever, not experienced, but I never, ever heard about something like that, that a Hungarian officer would say something like this. You know, it was just unheard. Anyhow, so I think I didn't really thank him or something. I just said, I think very simple, I just said, well, thank you, or something like that. And then, you know, I was in the car. And then, the car was, you know, they were not doing any customs on it or anything. This the captain just told to the guy that let the car go, it's okay. And so we pretty much, we were, we rolled out of Hungary. And again, it came a little bit of no man's land. And on the other side, you know, Austria, it was very different than what I have imagined. I don't know if I imagined anything else, but it certainly was very modest. I believe I remember one little simple house, border station or whatever, but it was really a small and modest one. And it was only one officer standing in the middle of the room. I mean, basically no personnel, no, you know, no docks, no watchtowers, no whatever. One soldier was standing in the middle of the room, and he was very, very exquisite. He was standing in, he had a black uniform on it. I believe that that's what their normal uniform. It reminded me very much of the SS. He looked like an SS, I don't know, Auschwitz, I don't know, Hauptmannführer or whatever. You know, it was a vision, basically, what I saw there. And he was just, he had a riding whip in his hand. You know, he had a black pelerine. He had this high hat, you know, and totally black. And he was just, as we poured up to it, he was just, we lowered down the window, and Zlatko, it was the name of this Yugoslav guy, he handed out the three passports in the red covers. And he wouldn't take it, but he would look at us one by one. He looked in everybody's eyes. He looked up the guy's eyes, but it was like, like good 4 or 5 seconds. Looked in the girl's eyes and looked into mine eyes. And then just winked us over. Dankeschön, auf Wiedersehen. And we were into Austria.
How did you feel at that moment?
I don't know. I mean, it wasn't much. I wasn't... It took a couple of minutes.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to LibsynAds.com now. That's LibsynAds.com.
Like 5 minutes until I realized that, hey, we are in Austria now. I'm over the border. You know, it's like I had to say it several times to myself. Hey, I came over. I'm over. I'm, you know. But I wasn't euphoric and I wasn't, you know, very emotionally engaged or whatever. It was a relief, yeah, I guess, in a way. And it was a small happiness, but deep inside, you know, I still didn't really believe in some way or another. I was still looking back, or aren't they coming after us, or, you know, something like that. But then we went into the first village, and then Zlatko told me that, well, all right, so you can hitchhike it from now on, because we are not planning to go to Vienna. We are planning to go back to Hungary. Basically what they did, and they actually told me without any remorse or whatever, they told me that they were actually smuggling cigarettes. They had 100 carton cigarettes on them in the car. And they would have liked just to put it down in Austria, to have a box there on a train station, a safety box or something like that, and put it down there and go back to Hungary to buy another 100 cartons or whatever and to come back to Austria again. And you smuggle cigarettes. I said, well, why do you smuggle cigarettes? I mean, aren't they here to buy? Well, yes, of course, they are here to buy, but in Hungary it's cheaper. So basically they were smuggling Ronhills, which is a Yugoslavia-made cigarette. And in Hungary it was cheaper than in Yugoslavia. So they came over to Hungary, bought the cigarettes, took it over to Austria, and then, sold it in Austria. And they could make, a decent amount of money on it. They were young. It was a young couple. They were university students somehow. And this was the way how they were, you know, fixing their living or staying at the university. And then we went into the first village and seeked up the train station to find this kind of deposit boxes. But the train stations was closed. It was late in the afternoon. It was like 8 o'clock in the evening or something like that time. And so went on to the second village and the third village, and everywhere was closed. So basically they had to come up to the Hauptbahnhof, to the main station in Vienna, to put down the goods there. So thus they took me all the way to Vienna. Hmm. And then we parted there. I was in Vienna. I didn't know anyone, of course. I had no uncle. I had nothing there.
And presumably you had no Austrian currency either.
I had a little currency, actually. No Austrian currency. I think I had 3,800 forints or something like that. Officially, you were allowed to take 800 forints out of the country. Actually, the Hungarian captain asked me if you have any money on me. And I said what I had. I said I had 3,800 forints and maybe I had, I don't know, like $50 or something like that. And he asked me, is it enough or shall I give some money to you? And I said, no. As I told you, my uncle awaits me on the other side of the border. So actually, I don't even need this money either. He said, okay.
You just absolutely found the best person to be on the border on that day, didn't you?
I believe so. Yes. And so there was, I was up there in Austria, and I know I had to take myself to Kufstein, where I had an address to seek up and where I will be taken care of, so to say. And, but it, you know, in the West or in Vienna as well, they are closing the stations for the night. So you can't stay at the station. You know, so I came out from the station and it started raining as well. And I didn't want to stay in the wet. There. So I saw a small police office right there. A small rotund circular building. It was like a small shop, basically, but it was a small police office. And I went in there. There was a guy, a young policeman, sitting on the table. He had a little TV in front of him. He was watching a Western film. He was alone in that station. And it was very funny because he had Austrian, he was wearing Austrian uniform, and his feet he put up on the desk. And he had cowboy boots. You know, it was so funny to see a police officer in cowboy boots. I haven't seen anything like that before. And he was watching a Western film. And, you know, he didn't saw me at the beginning. And I was watching with him the Western film for like 2-3 minutes before I addressed him. And it was very funny because the Western film, it was in German. That at that time they dubbed, or even today, I think they dubbed everything into German. So it was quite funny to watch a Western film in German. You know, and then after a while, you know, I said, hey, hello, excuse me. And he said, oh, sorry. And he stopped the TV and, yes, how can I help, whatever. And I started to tell him my story. Hello, my name is this and this. I'm coming from Transylvania. I'm moving on to Sweden, blah, blah, blah. I'm a political refugee from Romania, basically. And, you know, I have a train tomorrow morning, but, you know, it's raining outside and can I just stay here so that I don't get wet? And he said, no, you can't stay here. This is a official building. You can't stay here. But there is a motel where your kind of people, political refugees and so on, where they can spend the night, and where it is. He said, well, it's a große Schiffgasse 3. You know, you just go out and there is a tram here and you take the tram, you go four stops and you get off there and, you know, you find your way there. I said, well, okay, thank you very much, you know. Yeah, goodbye, blah, blah. So I came out and then I was found, took the tram, went up, went 3 stops. And then I get off because it became clear that he didn't say that I should go left or right. Which direction should I take the tram? So I get off after 3 stops and I started asking around, you know, große Schiffgasse, you know, but there were very few people on the street. Basically, I stopped, I think, 2 Italian tourists who had no idea where this Schiffgasse was, and some other, I think they were Arabs or something. And then, so I end up in a small square, and there was none in the square, except a beautiful young woman, was wearing red leather from top till toe. You know, it was a vision, or I don't know how to say it. It was like something absurd somehow, and but at the same time very beautiful. And so I approached, you know, and I asked, "Sorry, do you know where große Schiffgasse 3 is?" She said, "What?" I said, well, you see, I'm a political refugee from Transylvania, and I'm looking this motel or whatever, because, you know, I don't know where to spend the night. Well, she said, well, I don't know. But look, there comes a taxi. Let's ask him. You know, and he stopped the taxi and asked, do you know where Grosse Schiffgasse 3 is? And yes, taxi driver knew And then, can you explain? As I said, well, it's a bit far. I can't really explain it. Then the girl said, oh, okay, no problem. Just sit in. I'll take you there. I'm going to go that direction as well. So she put me in the cab, you know, and then the taxi driver took my backpack, you know, and put it in the in the Mercedes. I think it was the first time anyone took my backpack or whatever in my whole life, you know, like in the movies, basically. And then, yeah, we were riding along a good 8 to 10 minutes with the cab until we got to the Grosse-Schiff-Gasse, so it wasn't so near. Yeah. And I landed there 11:35 p.m. No, 11:25. And then, so this is it. You can go in. And I thank the girl. Thank you very much for taking me. Oh, it's nothing. Okay, have a good life. Blah, blah, blah. You know, and she went along. Okay. And then I went into this motel, and it was, they were 5 minutes from closing. 11:30, they would close. So I just got in, basically, in the last minutes. And in there were some Hungarians as well, you know, and they could help me with, you know, whatever. I got in a dormitory where there were 8 other peoples, but I got fresh sheets and everything. I could take a shower, and then, you know, I slept a good night. And the next day I paid for it. I think it was like around 800 forints. And then I headed back to the train station. And then as I went out, and I knew the first 2-3 street corners where to turn, but then not the rest of it. But finally, you know, I asked people in the street, how can I get back to the main train station? And everybody was really helpful, nice, normal people. And that they directed me how to go there, where I found the S-Bahn and Tunnelbahn and whatever. They even give me tickets, you know, to ride and so on and so on. Which is a bit funny, because as I was growing up, we had this, how should I say, legends of Germans or the Western people being very rigid and unfriendly and cold and so on. And it was very funny to me, and a very good feeling at the same time as well, that in my first day, I'm just only meeting friendly people and helpful people and decent people. And, you know, everything might not have been the same as we were told in Romania. You know? And so I find my way back to the train station. I change my money. I got some 600 or 800 shillings out of all my money. And I went on to buy a ticket to Kufstein. And then I realized that that ticket would cost me more than I had money. So I said, all right, so until where my money is good. And they say, it's good until Linz. Okay, so I'd like to have a ticket until Linz. So I bought a ticket until Linz, and I boarded the train, and I noticed that the first time when you board the train from the first station, you know, the conductor comes and, you know, and checks your tickets and so on, and it's okay. And the next time he's not checking the tickets anymore. He remembers you somehow. And the next time, you know, when the train stops, he would just ask that new passengers, and those ones who were new, they would put up their hands, you know, and he would go and only check them. And my funny Romanian logics said to me that after Linz, you know, when I didn't have a ticket anymore, I would not be raising my hand that I'm a new passenger or that I had no ticket.
You're learning just, fast. You know,
yes, I'm just keeping a low profile there. Yeah. You know, and then I got all the way until Vogel, I think it was called, at the German city, where I had to change trains. And for Vogel, there was I could go to Kufstein, and it was no stops in between, but it was like a 40-45 minutes ride. And I certainly had no tickets for that journey. But as lucky as I was, there was no conductor on that train. So I landed in Kufstein. It was afternoon and 4 or 5 o'clock, you know, and said, basically, I'm done. You know, I just go and seek out the address and then people will be there happy. So I woke up to the first cab, which was there, and I was asking the address. Hello, do you know this address? He looked at it and said, no, I do not know this address. What do you mean you do not know? I don't think there is an address like this here. Ah, I said to him, how long did you drive taxi, huh? All right, so I went to the second cab in the line. I had a novice taxi driver who didn't know his city. So I went to the second one, and he didn't know it either. Went to the third one, he didn't know it either. All right, so something is wrong. I didn't have any money. Not a coin, nothing. I couldn't even make a phone call, basically. And I was thinking, okay, so what shall I do now? Okay, when my father wrote down the address, so he might have misspelled something, I thought. So I said, okay, there is no address like this, but is there any similar? Well, similar, yes, similar. There is a good dozen. Okay. Which one is the nearest? And he said, well, the nearest is actually not too far. We just across the police station, like some 600 meters from here. Oh, okay, good. So I went and seeked up this first similar or looking like or could be address. I think it was number 5, which I was looking for. I found number 4 and I found number 6. I didn't find any number 5. So I was looking around, coming and going and asking around as well, that people didn't know about this number 5. So I still was looking around over there, and I found a little garden door, basically, but it was hardly a door. It was just, a very small door on a corner to something. And I said, okay, I'll try this. So I went into through this door, which led into a garden. And like a good 50, 60 meter from there, there was a huge house, 3 or 4 level house. And I went in there and I rang the bell, nothing. You know, I knocked on the door, nothing. And then I entered because the door was open. I went in, nobody was in there. Okay, I came out and I went around the house. It was a huge garage there. It was some motorbike there, some car. It was a motorboat there. And I said, well, I mean, they couldn't go so far. I mean, if everything is here and everything's open. So whoever lives here, they should be nearby. So I decided to wait. I couldn't do anything else either, anyhow. So I sat on the porch, and then I became thirsty as well. I went into the kitchen. I took out a bottle of beer from the fridge, and I went out to the porch, and I finished the beer there, and still nobody. And then after a good, another, I don't know, 15 to 20 minutes, this little garden door opened, and in came what I presume it was a family. But, you know, it was a woman, there was 2 or 3 smaller kids, and the guy, he was a very tall guy, like 2-meter guy, you know, and they just, I was sitting on their porch, and they went into the house by me, and they just nodded to me. You know, it was kind of strange situation. They went in, I was still sitting there, and I said, well, I should go after them, I guess, because, you know, I still have my questions. And they went in, and they were just coming from shopping, you know, and they were putting packaging up and, you know, sorting out the stuff. And then I said, hello, my name is this, and I'm coming from here and here, and I'm looking for this person. I'm looking for said the name Jozef.
Well, sorry,
we don't know Jozef. We don't know, but who are you? Well, you know, I'm a political refugee from Transylvania, you know, and I'm looking this contact. They said, well, we don't know any Jozef, but are you hungry? Or, you know, I said, well, yes. Well, why don't you sit with us and have dinner with us? Well, thank you very much. You're very kind. And so, well, thank you. So, you know, I sat down and had dinner with them. And then after a while, the door was opening and a young lady came in, a girl of like 20, 25. And he sat down and started to eat. And well, and then he spots me that I'm not known to her and say, oh, well, hi, who are you? Oh, well, he's a guy. He's looking for someone, but we don't know him. And we just invited him for dinner. Okay. So who are you? I said, I'm a political refugee. I'm looking for this man. What did you say? Jozef. Well, yeah, I know Jozef. You know Jozef? Yeah, of course. Daddy, you know too. He works for you. He works for me, but who? I don't know any Jozef. No, he's not Jozef, he's Yosef. As they said it in German. Oh, Jozef, of course we know Jozef. Yeah. Well, the girl said, well, just finish your dinner, and after dinner I will take you to Jozef. Thank you. And that's what happened, you know. We sat in her car, and he took me out of the town, because this guy was not living in Kufstein. I mean, maybe in the administrative district of Kufstein, but he was living outside the town by a little forest, a house alone by himself. So basically, I wouldn't stand a chance to found this house by myself. Okay, so we're going in there, and as we are turning into to the driveway to the house, Golf is a car is leaving on the other side, going out, and the girl said, "Well, that's Jozef car. Let's pop off." And you know, we ran him up with the car, and he stopped, and it showed that they were going to a vacation to Italy. They were on their way to a vacation, so we pretty much catch them in the last minute. Basically, you know, 1 minute and I would be stranded there, basically, more or less. I say, yeah, I know you were coming, Jozef said, but I thought you were not coming until next week or something. Well, I'm here. Blah, blah, blah. Okay. And then the girl parted, whatever. And then Jozef said, well, you know, well, we are on our way. You know, you can stay here in the house. I mean, the fridge is full. There is books, you know, you can read and so on and so on. You know, you can rest for a week and then I come back in a week and then we'll work out how to, you know, how can I help you over to Germany. I said, yeah, sure. Okay, it works fine for me. I mean, I love more than, you know, sit around and read books and, you know, but yeah, I will be okay. And then he took out some Hungarian food and we had some palinka as well. This is the Hungarian whiskey. And, you know, he was talking a bit and so, and he said, you know what, I mean, since you're here, I can delay my journey a day and let me see if I can smuggle you over today. I said, yeah, it works for me fine. I mean, I'm here anyhow. So he started to make some phone calls and after half an hour said, well, okay, let's try tonight. Let's try tonight. I said, okay. And the way we did it, it was that he had an Italian wife and he had a kid of around 3-4 years old and he had a newly born kid. Well, newly born, it was like 6-7 months. So his wife would be driving the Golf. The bigger kid would be in the back seat. And I would be in the front seat holding the little baby.
Hi, this is Rhonda in Virginia, and I support Cold War Conversations because I think the work that Ian is doing is critically important. I think it's vital to record the firsthand accounts of people who lived and experienced the Cold War. because it illustrates history in a way that a book never can. So thank you so much for the podcast. It's my favorite podcast, and I look forward to it every week.
To be like Rhonda and help to preserve these incredible stories of the Cold War, as a monthly or annual supporter, you'll be able to listen ad-free, you'll become one of our community, get the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster as a thank you, and you'll bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate to find out more.
And thus we went to the border. In Kufstein, there's a border between Austria and Germany. So, so we just rode there. The weather was the same. It was still gloomy and rainy and so on. And at this time, we put my green Romanian pass into a black cover, which the Austrian passes had. So again, she showed out the two Austrian passes, so to say, to the border, and she looked, the border officer looked in, looked around, and he waved us over. So we were in Germany, and we went to the first village and waited there. And Joseph came after us with his car, and we met up in this little village. I sat over to the to Joseph's car, and the girl with the wife with the two kids returned back to Kufstein. The reason why we did it like this, it was because when Joseph came, the border police know him. So they, so to say, looked him, they controlled him. He had to step out of the car, open the, you know, so they controlled it. And then with Joseph, then I sat in the car and we drove 200-300 kilometers until Frankfurt, I believe, or some German city. It was there were Transylvanians there as well. I believe it was a doctor and his wife. And we were there having dinner, and Joseph turned back from there and went back home. And another guy came to pick me up there from Stuttgart, near Stuttgart. So he picked me up and he rode again all 2-3 hours all the way up to Stuttgart. And I stayed there for 3 days. And then he gave me money. Gave me, I think, 400 Deutschmarks. And from there, I bought a train ticket all the way to Jönköping, where I was supposed to go from the first place. And then, you know, after a couple of days, I boarded the train and I, went on my journey. It was very funny when we came to Stuttgart as well, because in this guy's house, I saw it was nighttime when we arrived there, and I wanted to take a shower. I never ever met a shower before, which was with a photo cell. You know, like I haven't never ever seen anything like that. That you had to, you know, just be there and the water would be running. Yeah. So I was there like I don't know, like a total idiot, and I didn't understand what it's happening. You know, so I put my hand in, and there's water. I step into it, there is no water. You know, you had to stand in a different or in a certain way, you know, to get water. So it was very funny. So I spent a good half an hour there taking a shower until I managed. But it was kind of, you know, the small ways, the small meetings with this new kind of life. And so basically, I went over to the train station after 3 days there. I bought my ticket all the way to Jönköping, boarded my train, and went up to Hamburg. And in Hamburg, I had to wait like 6 hours to the next train. So I went out, and where did I end up? In St. Pauli. You know, so it's I heard about San Paoli before, you know, but it's a different thing of hearing, and it's a different thing of experiencing it.
Yeah.
And plus it was some kind of festival as well, some kind of autumn festival there as well. So it was, it was good vibes. And from there, I wrote a postcard to my parents as well that I wrote it, well, my dear father and mother, I'm writing you from Hamburg. You don't know it yet, but you know that I'm not there, but I decided to jump off. I'm sorry for this decision that I had made. So it was kind of a letter that, you know, which would come to the post station in KSD. And then, you know, the Securitate, the secret police would certainly see it and so on and so on. So they shouldn't blame my parents.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so I could, you know, just... and then, you know, I went over to Oldenburg, I guess, and I had different trains all the way up to until I took the Copenhagen Express. And the way the train goes over to Denmark is like they are boarding the whole train to the ship, and it boards off on the other side. And I was talking to my brother, and he said, well, what's going to happen there is that when border police comes up before Puttgarten, the German border city, is they're going to check you, and they're going to take you off the train, and they're going to hold you probably one night to check up if you're not a terrorist or somebody, you know, wanted and so on and so on. But since you are not, you know, and you're leaving the country, they will let you, you know, board the train the next day. And you can come, just, you know, expect that this is the procedure. This is what's going to happen. I said, okay, fair enough. And so, you know, I kind of was expecting the border police and, you know, that I'm going to spend the night in a cell. More or less. So I put my backpack in one of the compartments, and I stood by the window, and I remember that I was smoking Kim cigarettes by the window. And the border police came, and since I was standing by the door, I opened the door and I said, you know, guten Tag. And they said, guten Tag, danke schön, bitte sehr, you know, and I closed the door after them. And they went on and, you know, started to check people and so on and so on. And I was still standing by the window and I was still smoking. And then after a while, they were coming back. I opened the door and I said, and they said, danke schön. And I said, bitte sehr. And they left. They did not check me.
So you see, politeness goes a long way.
Oh, yes, it does. It does. Somehow. And then we went over to Rødby, which is the Danish city on the other side. And then the Danish border control came, and I handed over my passport. He looked at it and he asked me, should I put a stamp in it or not? I said, well, I don't know. I said, well, you know, if you wish, I can put a stamp. And if you don't want a stamp, I don't put a stamp. Well, I said, I don't know what's the normal procedure. I mean, do as you feel. I mean, do as you have to do. I know. Oh, okay, then I put a stamp. And he stamps my passport and he handed back. Because, you know, I had a valid passport. The reason why we couldn't leave Romania, it's not because, let's say, the Austrians would not let us in, or the Germans or whoever, but because usually the communist bloc, like in this way, the Hungarian, would not let us out.
Yeah.
You know, as I remember, we didn't need a visum to, let's say, Denmark, because it was a visa-free way, because it was no Romanians coming to Denmark anyhow, because they were not let out of the country. So I had a good passport on myself, you know, so it was not a problem. So we went over to all the way to Copenhagen, and in Copenhagen I had to change trains again to Stockholm. And this train was a nighttime train. So from Copenhagen, then we had sea crossing again at Helsingborg, from Denmark to Sweden. That was a shorter one. And then we were into Sweden. After we went over to Sweden, you know, it was nighttime. Some people were still reading, and most of the people were sleeping in the train. And it was a lot of people in the train. It was the end of August. A lot of people were returning to Sweden, and so on. So it was a full train. And after a while, I saw that the border control was approaching. Now, the Swedish officers had a different uniform that I had seen before, you know, because I was, you know, used to normal, so-called normal uniforms. But the Swedish officers had a working like the dock workers had. I don't know.
Like an overall.
Like an overall. That's the word. Yeah, like they had an overall on themselves. So they were, kind of funny looking. But I saw that as well, that they were not checking everybody. They were just asking passports of those who were awake. You know, those who were sleeping, they didn't bother. A sudden sleepiness came over me. And then, you know, I'm sleeping. And they, the guy next to me, he was sleeping already. And he had a jeans jacket on him, which fell off as he was turning around or whatever in his sleep. So the border guy, the police officer, took up his coat from the ground and put back on him, you know, and they left. I waited 2-3 minutes, you know, and I looked around. No, they were gone. Which meant that basically I was in Sweden, you know.
Wow.
And then after like 5 or 10 minutes, something like that, the conductor came. And it was a small person. It was a woman of like 30-ish or something like that. And I gave her my train ticket. He controlled it, said thank you, and said Norrköping. And gave it back to me. And she left. And I was sitting there thinking, she said, Norrköping. I think it's not where I am going. And I opened my ticket and checked it, and it said Jönköping in my. Aha. So something is wrong here. Am I on the wrong train or what's happening? So I went after her. I catch her up in the next wagon. And I ask, I'm sorry, you said something in Norrköping, but I'm going to Jönköping. You said, this is my ticket. Well, yes, but in order to get to Jönköping, you will have to go off in Norrköping and change trains. Uh-huh, okay, I didn't know that. So where is this Norrköping? Well, this is like 150 kilometers from Jönköping. So we are going over Jönköping and then I have to come back? Well, yes, because you should change train here in Nässjö in order to be able to go to Jönköping. So tomorrow or in the morning when we're going to be in Norrköping, you have to come back to Nässjö, change trains here, and then you can go from there to Jönköping. Well, I said, but wait a minute, it's not working for me. I don't have money, you know, it's Jönköping, I want to go. I'm a political refugee from Romania. I'm a Transylvanian, you know, I don't know how to cope with that situation. Can't you help me if we are going through this Nässjö or whatever it's called? Can we just stop there for a moment, you know, or whatever, or what can we do? And she said, no, we can't stop. I mean, this is the international night train from Copenhagen to Stockholm. It doesn't stop. The first stop is in Rob. But you see, my situation, it's she said, wait, okay, wait, let me see what can I do. And then she took out her phone, you know, this train phone, and he was talking to the train driver, train engineer. And then he put it down. He said, well, okay, basically, we could stop for a short moment.
In unbelievable.
Yeah.
Unbelievable. You've got a real gift. You've got such a gift.
And basically, that's what happened as well. You know, when we got to Nashua and they announced it in the train because, you know, people were waiting up and looking out what happened. I mean, we're not supposed to stop. And they announced it both in Swedish and English that we're not supposed to stop here, but we have a political refugee from Romania who heads to Jönköping, and this is how we can help him. And we apologize to all of you for this short break, but we will be continuing short. And then I was standing on Nashua all by myself. Of course, nobody was getting off the train during the night time with my nice Transylvanian yellow backpack. And the people were out on the train windows. They were listening to what was being announced. And then when I heard the story, they said, "Well, yeah, hey," and they were applauding and said, cheering and have a good life. Yeah, all the best, you know, like, wow, yep. Where did I
Brilliant.
Got myself into? I mean, this people are decent. And I don't know, you know, just all these positive waves all around.
Yeah.
So it's, yeah. And then I spent the night there as well because that train station was closed as well from the outside, but from the inside it was okay. So I spent the night there with three guys. I guess they had the same, they were in the same situation as I were, I guess. And then in the morning the train came and I continued to Jönköping. And when I got to Jönköping, then I called my brother on the phone and he came and fetched me. He was at, you know, a family. I mean, he had she had a girlfriend, of course, from Transylvania. That was the main reason he was leaving Hungary as well to come up to Sweden. So that his family. And then he fetched me to family. And then his girlfriend, I took a shower and I had a breakfast, and then his girlfriend, who already knew Swedish by that, took me to the police to, you know, register and said, here I am. So went into the police and Dildiko was translating, and then I got this registration and then went over to the immigration office and then I registered there as well. They asked me if, you know, how would I like to stay? And I said, well, what do you mean? I mean, would you like to stay to Transylvania, another Transylvania? I said, well, of course. And then, you know, we went over and bought some basic stuff like towels and those kind of stuff. And we went up there. We were in I was put in a flat with a fellow Transylvanian guy. And yeah, there we lived together for like 6-7 months until we got our permits, resident permits and everything else.
Incredible. Incredible. What was that moment like when you met your brother? It must have been emotional or not?
It was kind of emotional because, you know, I mean, we did it, but we didn't really believed it, that it could really happen or that I could really succeed somehow. But, and yet, yes, you know, so we're sending there. So, you know, yeah, but well, we didn't had any tears and see and so, but we just went on like business as usual, basically, you know, like, okay, I did it. Here I am. Okay. So what's the next step? Basically. You know, but of course we were, I believe I was emotionally, you know, touched and so on and so why we did it. I mean, but everything was new and, you know, you were just looking around and, you know, taking in everything. It was a dream which came true, which you never, ever allowed yourself to dream.
That's a great line. That is a lovely. Lovely line. Were there any repercussions with your parents as a result of you leaving the country?
They called them, I think, two or three times into the local Securitate office. And, you know, they were trying to whatever, they were persecuting them and interrogating them and see it and so on. But that level of Securitate in my hometown was, how should I say, not so severe. My father was a well-known person in the city, and you know they were Hungarian officers, some of the Hungarian officers in the Securitate as well, and they didn't really want to make a big thing out of it. But let me just add to it that in 1988, by that time my parents were retired, and they came out to visit us in Sweden. 1998, it's still communism back in Romania. And then we persuaded them to stay in Sweden. And after us, that their two children was already living in Sweden, they got political asylum as well, in a month or something. It went very fast. So they stayed in Sweden. And in 1989, that is a half year after they stayed in Sweden, our house was demolished in KSD.
Was that in retaliation for them not coming back?
Not really in retaliation, but because they wanted to build a new housing neighborhood there, you know, and basically they took the house, they took the garden, they took everything, and what they paid, it was a small sum, basically. Small amount of money, so that it's what it's really worth. And the long my father was home, I mean, he could resist in this in one or other way. But when he left, then, you know, nobody was there.
And I guess it was probably easier for them to leave Romania because they were pensioners at that point, and it meant Romania, if they didn't come back, it meant Romania no longer had to pay their pension. There's further information such as photos and videos in our episode notes, which will show as a link in your podcast app. Now, this podcast would not exist without our financial supporters, and I want to thank one and all of them for their generous support. If you want to help us, just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate for more information. And you can also join our Facebook group where listeners just like you continue the Cold War conversation. Thanks very much for listening. It is really appreciated. Goodbye. Not enjoying the ads? Well, you can avoid them by going to coldwarconversations.com/donate. By becoming a monthly or annual supporter, you'll enjoy ad-free listening, become a part of our community, receive the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster, and bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate for more information.